The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I've been thinking a lot about the late Christopher Hitchens. He died in 2011. I interviewed him once in 2003. We talked about a lot of things during that conversation, including his support for the invasion of Iraq, which had just recently occurred. And we talked about whether Osama bin Laden was alive or dead. We talked about Bill and Hillary Clinton. And we talked about nuclear North Korea. I wonder what he would be thinking these days. I would love to know. Here's Christopher Hitchens, recorded in 2003 from the Best of the Book Nook.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. It's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Christopher Hitchens. He's got a new book out. He joins us by telephone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. My honor.
Christopher, before we get into this book, I imagine we have at least a couple of listeners out there that aren't familiar with you or any of your work. Can you give us a little biography of yourself? Is that possible?
Oh, God, can't you do that bit? I wouldn't know when to begin or when to stop. I'm a freelance hack. I write a column for Vanity Fair every month on cultural, political matters. It varies. The last one I did actually was from Iraq. I've published a couple of books. The most recent one, apart from this one, was about George Orwell for his centennial, which is this year. I do quite a bit of foreign reporting. I like to write about literature, but I keep getting dragged back into politics. I guess if you hated that, you could turn off now. And I'm a strong supporter of the idea of getting rid of totalitarian dictatorships like those of Saddam Hussein. I was for the regime change policy before George Bush was, when he was governor. When he was the candidate, he wasn't for it. He was against nation building and so on. And I'd be for it still if he changed his mind. And so I wrote the book, this book is a collection of my arguments during the run-up to the war, to see how the original arguments hold up in retrospect, see if they were any good, submit them to the judgment of the public, and remind people of what the principle was in the first place. That's the idea.
You make the statement that only hindsight works. In hindsight, where were you wrong about some of these ideas?
Well, I'm personally astounded rereading it and how well it all holds up. I thought that it would be militarily fairly easy, that it would be among Iraqis fairly popular, that regime change had already been demonstrated in the northern sixth of the country, that's to say in Iraqi Kurdistan, which was freed from Saddam in 1991 and protected by a no-fly zone. I think it would have been better to do the whole thing in 1991 and to have supported the nationwide rebellion against Saddam Hussein that time and taken him down then. I think the people who said that at the time have been proved right. So I'm talking about others being proved right, not myself. I say that on the weapons of mass destruction question, I said early before it began, I don't think that he can have very many of them, but he has a design to reacquire them if he can, and he might be able to get them off the shelf from North Korea if things are allowed to go on any longer, so that the difference I had with the administration's line was I didn't think it was necessary to scare people into wanting to get rid of Saddam Hussein, scary though he is. It would have been better to make a stronger human rights case and case for self-determination for Iraqis and Kurds.
Do you think he's alive?
But any regime change policy, I think, in my opinion, was better than none.
Uh-huh.
And the risk of chaos and disorder in Iraq was much stronger if there wasn't an intervention, because the regime was going to implode and the society was going to melt down if nothing was done. So a maimed Iraq, a traumatized Iraq, was in our future in any case. On all these things, I think I can still defend myself pretty well. And I think some of the people who were opposed to the war were also dealing in fear and hysteria and warning of appalling dire consequences that never occurred.
There was an article in USA Today today that said something about Baghdad is fairly chaos and anarchy right now. Do you think most Iraqis feel like they're better off now without Saddam and with the anarchy that they're having to deal with?
Well, I haven't been in Baghdad since the intervention began. I've been in Iraq, in southern Iraq, in some very poor and dusty small villages around there. This was a while ago, so I can only rely on what I saw with my own eyes. There was a mixture of opinion there. People were relieved but suspicious. They weren't sure then that Saddam Hussein was really gone or was really going to go. There were some people who had liked him, not very many. I don't think there will be much nostalgia for him, no. It does seem to me very culpable, though, of the U.S. administration that it didn't realize how much immediate need there was going to be for repair and care and humanitarian work right in the aftermath. But then I think, you see, they were kind of surprised themselves at how quickly they defeated his forces.
There seems to be a lot of cultural looting going on at archaeological sites, and of course we had the library and the museum that were looted.
Well, those are two different things. There's been an illegal trade in Iraqi antiquities, some of it winked at or colluded in by the Baathist authorities for a long time now. There was certainly some terrible looting and destruction at the National Museum and the library. But now we know more. It seems possible that might have been a cover for something much more sinister, which was an organized theft using, you know, real tools and equipment done from the inside before anyone found out, and possibly before the United States forces were in control of the city. In other words, that argues for an inside job. It turns out that some of the early reports of total destruction were not true, and also not just that many more artifacts survived than we thought, but many, many have been recovered. I mean, in other words, the Iraq Museum will rise again, and it would be a very good project for non-government organizations and for interested Americans to help out with. But I think Iraq itself will rise again.
My guest is Christopher Hitchens. His book is A Long, Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. He joins us in the Book Nook today. It's a Slate book, and it's been published by Plume. And I'm wondering, is Saddam alive? If so, where is he? Where are his sons, the one that ran off with the millions of dollars?
I know, it's extraordinary. The taking out of that money argues that they had a bolt hole plan of some sort, but it also argues that the speed with which it was done and the lateness. I mean, they took the money out only a couple of nights before it would have been impossible. But they also hadn't realized how fast things were going to happen. I don't believe that any other country would shelter Saddam Hussein at the moment.
So where is he?
And I don't think that he will be wanting to show his face either. And it's possible that he needs some kind of care. I mean, apart from being a raving paranoid and psychopath, we don't really know what the state of his health is, but it has in the past been said to be poor. He's needed surgery and so forth. It's really impossible to say. There's not enough to go on. I mean, I for example, would say fairly confidently that I think Mr. Bin Laden is no longer with us.
You think he's dead?
I think he's been dead for some time, and my induction is a fairly simple one. His supporters want to prove that he's alive. It obviously matters to them to have people believe that he's alive, and yet they can't do it. They can't produce the proof, and proof of life isn't that hard to do, and they've produced some stuff that's fake and some that's very questionable. The task of proving life is pretty simple. You just need to have a believable short clip of him reading a current newspaper. They can't do that. They seem to be, in other ways, a bit leaderless and dispersed. I think there's every chance that he's gone.
Is that why?
With Saddam, you don't have that kind of thing to go on, because he wouldn't have the same motive to show his face. He would be interested in concealing his whereabouts and making a mystery. So one can't reason in quite the same way.
With this theory that Osama bin Laden is no longer with us, is this part of the reason why you feel it's unlikely that the Iraq war will make the problem worse with al-Qaeda?
Well, I don't think it can possibly make it worse, no, because I don't see how it can be in the interest of al-Qaeda to have almost the only government in the world that would welcome its fugitives onto its territory removed. I mean, we don't know the full extent of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party's collusion with al-Qaeda, but we know more and more about it. It went on longer than we thought. It started earlier than we imagined. It was done in a kind of deniable way, based on having a common enemy and a mutual interest. But it was undoubtedly there. Now they don't have a capital city where they can feel welcome anymore. Mm. That can't be what they wanted. It may be that anti-American feeling, they hope, will be ratcheted up, but there was going to be anti-American feeling no matter what, it seems to me. Mm. Unless you decide, okay, let's not make them angry, let's not quarrel with Saddam Hussein. Well, that, of course, would be a hopeless and pathetic position. You'd be saying we mustn't do anything that would upset al-Qaeda. Well, on the contrary, the good test of a policy is if it annoys al-Qaeda.
My guest is Christopher Hitchens. The book is A Long, Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. We've had a while now to bring democracy to Afghanistan. How's that going? Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think it's taking place? Do you think the people there are better off than they were under the Taliban?
Well, I don't. To answer your questions in reverse, there's no question at all about the latter point. I mean, obviously, everyone's better off, and one of the largest problems Afghanistan has now is refugees who've come back to the tune of between 1.5 and 2 million from fairly wretched exile in camps and diaspora elsewhere. Some people say they came back hearing that things were better than they were or than they are. Nonetheless, it's a pretty big vote of confidence if people move back to a country, and it's no longer, as a country, either the host of the al-Qaeda network, so that's a positive, I think, one would have to say. I don't think that in one's lifetime one will see anything like an effective central or federal system in Afghanistan, but it's no longer in complete free fall into the Stone Age as it was under the Taliban. It has a pulse again, in other words. Uh-huh. And even some of these so-called warlords, warlord is an odd term because it's obviously a pejorative, but sometimes it just means local power broker. I mean, even some of these guys, many of whom fought against the Taliban, are at least in their little region, doing a certain amount for reconstruction and relief of poverty and so forth. The crucial thing, by the way, about warlordism is, you want to know what the definition of a warlord really is it's someone who controls a stretch of the road.
Uh-huh.
So the key thing that's happening in Afghanistan now, it's happening much too slowly, is the building of a Kabul to Kandahar highway. I mean, a proper road, not an interruptible track, where anyone who can roll a boulder into the road can call himself a roadblock and a local government.
Uh-huh.
I think it's infrastructure work of that sort that's really important, and that's where one would like to see what we politely call the donor community doing a bit more spade work than it has been.
The Bush administration went into Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction. They're still looking. We know for sure that North Korea possesses such weapons, and countries like Pakistan. The guys running these countries aren't quite normal. What do you think about these countries, and do you think there should be some intervention there by the U.S.?
Well, in Pakistan, there is an intervention. In other words, the government of General Musharraf survives as a result of American support, very largely, and certainly the military part of it depends upon America, and to that extent, its behavior with nuclear weapons can be, to some extent, conditioned. I think it was a terrible mistake to let the Pakistanis acquire nuclear weapons and also to carry on denying that they were doing so. I think that's a hideous mistake by past American administrations, which we're all going to pay for. And I think that one of the most threatening contexts in the world at the moment, if not the most dangerous of all, is the possibility of an India-Pakistan nuclear exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not entitled, whatever else comes up, and urgent things do come up, that should never go off our screen. With North Korea, unfortunately, North Korea managed to do what Saddam Hussein always hoped to do, namely to get a nuclear weapon in secret and then announce it had one. And they say, now what are you going to do about it? Because there's everyone's nightmare right there, a mad dictator with nuclear weapons. Now it's finally happened. No one knows what to do. Picture what would have happened if Saddam Hussein had been in that position, which he very nearly was. You see, that's why I say my book, that's why I entitle it The Long Short War. In 1990, he had a choice. He could finish developing his nuke, which almost no one understood that he'd nearly acquired, which didn't get taken away from him till after his disaster in Kuwait. Uh-huh. Or he could, but anyway, think of him, just in 1990, he had the option, I can either invade Kuwait or I can finish my bomb. He later publicly made a speech saying it was the worst mistake he'd ever made was to invade Kuwait before he'd got the nuke. If he'd had the nuke, he could still be in charge of Kuwait, and he'd have doubled his income and could be building a lot of other weapons. And no one could go in to dig him out without the real, genuine fear that he would rather use the nuclear weapon than surrender.
Do you see any irony in the fact that Saddam came into power in large part through intervention of our Central Intelligence Agency?
I think irony is not quite the right word for that.
Okay.
Well, there is a word that is in common circulation, which it's in common circulation for a good reason. It's called blowback. It's what happens when you pursue a short-term, short-sighted policy and you bequeath long-term, ghastly results. There are several such examples in American foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
One reason I like this policy is it's a break with that one, if you see what I mean. Yeah. I hadn't finished quite on the weapons question,
okay.
By the way.
Okay.
Look, people are having a good laugh at the moment at this apparently fruitless search. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that no more weapons are going to be found. I don't mind making the assumption. I'm not perfectly certain that it's true. I think a design to reacquire weapons will probably be unearthed. But never mind. Let's grant this. Well, then it's interesting, because it's not very long since Saddam Hussein made a public declaration of what weapons he did hold. And it was a lot of chemical and a biological and nerve agent. He said, okay, this much I admit to having. I doubt he was overstating the amount, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, where did it go? No one says he didn't have them.
He must have gotten rid of them.
But why didn't he try and take credit for that? Because the United Nations kept demanding of him that he come into compliance with a series of resolutions, which he didn't. Not even when pressed by Blix. Not even Blix could claim that he'd complied with 1441. Well, why not? He could have prolonged his life and the life of his regime by doing so. By the way, that takes care of the argument, if I'm right, that he was a rational actor who understood deterrence and self-preservation and trade-offs. He seems to have behaved with unbelievably insane rashness.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to have a lot of deadly weapons. Now he doesn't have any. That, in my view, means, if you take the long view, the policy was a success. Some combination of sanctions, occasional aerial bombardment, deterrence, containment, believable threat of the use of force and the use of it has disarmed Saddam Hussein. Rather annoyingly, we don't know which bit was the successful one.
As you say...
But nor does anybody else. So, I mean, this kind of aha, gotcha mentality that's going around now, as if a weapon was just something you could pull a curtain back, you know, say, aha, we found it, we've got it. It's not like that. It's a scientific process, the acquisition of weaponry. It'll need a careful analysis to see where they exactly were. But I don't believe Saddam Hussein kicked out the UN inspectors in, what, 98? And thought, hey, now the inspectors have gone. Hmm. Now I can really get on with disarming Iraq. I don't think so somehow, do you?
I'm not sure.
It doesn't seem in the nature of the guy. The acquisition of weapons of mass destruction meant everything to him. He diverted titanic resources. He starved his country half to death to get this done. The idea that he just gave up on the idea but thought, but why bother to tell the UN?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense. So I think we have to remain open-minded about this, but the fact is I'm annoyed with the people who are talking with discontent about the evident fact that by one means or another the regime change policy did disarm him.
So, as you say, it was successful, but wouldn't it have been more prudent back at the end of the first Gulf War to take care of this? We could have had 12 years of Reconstruction already, and we wouldn't have had that Shiite uprising where America possibly encouraged it, and then it was kind of like a Hungarian uprising where we didn't come in and back them up.
I would add nothing to what you've just said.
Okay.
That's precisely my view, and it's what I say in the book as well. Not that I'm accusing you of borrowing my stuff, of course. but, of course, I don't know why people say it's easy to be wise after the event. It's often extremely difficult to be wise after the event, I found. But I would prefer to say that I think those who argued in 91, let us not betray the rebellion. Let's finish with this evidently very dangerous and destabilizing guy. We're right. I think they were right, and I'm glad they've won the argument in the long run.
I recently saw the film The Trials of Henry Kissinger, which in large part I think owes a lot of its ideas to you. You made the point in that book that Henry Kissinger should be considered a war criminal. Is that right?
I think he's guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity and also of gross crimes against American law and the U.S. Constitution. And I think I can prove all that in the book. And I'd like to take at least a little bit of the credit for the initiatives taken by magistrates in various democratic countries now, France, Argentina, and Chile most notably, and also a civil suit brought in a federal court in Washington to bring him to justice, to prosecute him, or at least to ask him to be deposed about what he knows about crimes against humanity and war crimes.
Were you stunned by the coincidence that in Chile on September 11th, 1973, something happened, and then all these years later, something happened on 9/11, and Kissinger was asked to investigate? Did that make you boggle?
When I heard that Bush had nominated Kissinger to head the 9/11 Commission, I thought, well, the Chile coincidence is the least of it. I mean, for one thing, here is a guy who is wanted for, you know, at least for questioning, on grounds that he participated in international terrorism, such as, you know, commissioning the assassination via the diplomatic pouch of an official in a democracy with which the United States was not at war. In fact, a leading general in Chile, General Schneider, who was opposed to a coup. That's whose family, by the way, is suing Kissinger in Washington.
Right.
Then I thought, well, what about his client list? And I was actually the first to point this out. How can he possibly continue to keep his client list of Kissinger associates secret, since we know a lot of his business is in the Middle East, if he's going to do an impartial investigation? Then since he's under investigation in so many countries, how can he be able to travel freely for his inquiries, since there are several countries where he can no longer land without being exposed at least to the possibility of being detained? The whole thing's an absolute scandal. Anyway, of course, he copped a plea on the most trivial of the three and said, actually, I decline the honor of this commission if I have to publish my client list. But at least that gave some of the conservatives in the administration a view, perhaps for the first time, of the kind of guy they're up against, what sort of a person he is. I think that was quite educational.
Speaking of conservatives in the administration, John Ashcroft is trying to expand the Patriot Act right now. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I have strong views about Ashcroft in general. I mean, I think he could perhaps be a good Secretary of Agriculture, but I doubt it. I don't think that a person as ignorant of the law and the Constitution as he is should be allowed anywhere near the Justice Department, and I think this is proved all the time. It's going to be essential in the battle against Islamic gangsterism and its surrogates in this country that we make a clear distinction between friend and foe. There are many, many people in Islamic society who don't want to be governed by Sharia law any more than you or I do. Mixing them up and indiscriminately rounding them up and so on is a crime against the struggle against these people. And I think the same about Ashcroft's attitude to theocracy in non-Islamic society. In other words, he quite evidently believes that America, if it is not now, should be declared to be a Christian society. Run by people who, as he put it, have no king but Jesus. Well, excuse me, we have no king at all in this country, and that's all that needs to be said.
Well, as a charter member of Atheists for Regime Change, I can understand your opinion there.
It's a small but tenacious minority.
My guest is Christopher Hitchens. The book is A Long, Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. He joins us in the Book Nook today, and I know we're running out of time, and there's so many things to talk about. You've spent a good part of your career as a bit of a pit bull, and you almost made a career over the two terms of former President Clinton of savaging him. Do you have any thoughts on his current career and that of his wife, who apparently just came out in her new book as saying that she almost divorced him over Monica Lewinsky?
Yes, though she seems to contradict the two other published accounts by colleagues of hers of when he actually told her.
Hmm.
Though the discrepancy is only a matter of days between her being told by lawyers and friends and being then told by her ever-loving husband. But she's asking us to believe in any case that she's too stupid to be a senator. If she could have gone that long and wondered if possibly he was carrying on with an intern and lying about it in a sexual harassment lawsuit.
Uh-huh.
She knew very well what his form was like long before this, and everyone knows that she knew. So why she wants to act stupid and self-pitying is beyond me, but she seems to think that we owe her for all that she's suffered, and that maybe the Senate seat won't be enough, but perhaps only the nomination will wash away her tears. I'm very much against people who go into politics for therapy.
Hmm.
And I think Clinton wasted 8 years of everybody's time by trying to use public life to exorcise his personal demons and failing, but I don't think he should have been given the chance. I think we should develop the antennae that allow us to weed out plausible psychos early on, and I'm afraid that we aren't good enough at seeing them coming.
You strike me as a person who derives a lot of enjoyment from causing conniption fits among other people, pundits, and what have you. And
No, I consider it a very painful duty.
Well, I was amused. I went online and I checked out a few things, and I went in there and I saw this recent column by Alexander Coburn where he's talking about going into Google and searching breasts, martinis, Hitchens. Do you have any thoughts on this whole rigmarole?
I can't say I'm among Mr. Coburn's readers.
Okay.
But I...
He claims that some quote you made about comparing martinis to breasts was something that was derived from some other source. And Herb Cain, I think. You hadn't heard about this?
No, I mean, I remember, I wrote once that with martinis, the rule about the same rule as you would with the female poitrine, yes, one is too few,
uh-huh.
and three can be too many.
Okay.
Two is about right.
Right.
I don't claim that I thought of it myself, but I don't, if anyone ever said it to me, it could very well have been Herb Cain.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if I have it in memory... I used to drink with Herb. It could well have been from him.
Okay. So there we have it. We've got the answer to that burning question. All of our listeners were wondering what that was all about. Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, it's nice of you to ask me.
Hey, hold the phone. My guest has been Christopher Hitchens. The book is A Long, Short War, The Postponed Liberation of Iraq. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2003 interview with Christopher Hitchens, who died in 2011. At the time we recorded that, they were calling him a liberal hawk. He was quite a thinker and quite a controversial figure. He once said, "Organized religion is the main source of hatred in the world." I loved the opportunity to talk to him. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.